Welcome to Business Watch. Veteran investor Jeremy Grantham caused a stir this week when he warned that financial markets should brace for further pain, with global economic health at its most precarious level in years due to stubborn inflation, hawkish central banks, and geopolitical tensions. Grantham is the co-founder and chief strategist of asset manager GMO, and he told the Reuters Global Markets Forum that this is a more dangerous looking moment in global economics than even the madness of the housing bubble of 2007. Over in Europe, the energy crisis is being labeled the Minsky moment. Whatever the band-aid solution that's applied, the reality is fairly grim in Europe, and the math is simple. Europe can't print more natural gas, oil or coal, so one way or another it will have to offset the surging costs, first in commodities and then in all downstream value chains, which in the very near future will mean governments will soon be subsidizing Europe's cost of living, as the alternative is most likely a revolution of some sorts. In short, we're about to see the printers go brrr like never before, if only to prevent Europeans from going brrr this winter. While second quarter GDP and costs of living are also grappling and gripping the cabinet at the moment, we've got Cabinet Lekgotla here in South Africa discussing this issue. So lots to unpack with Warwick Lucas, head of Galileo Securities, and Raymond Parsons, who's a professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University. Warwick, it's fast and it's furious, and it's also toxic for other asset classes. It's the rise in 10-year U.S. real yields. It's seen by some as the true benchmark for borrowing costs, which have soared over the last 6 months from negative territory while the Fed turned more hawkish. And that's the biggest surge since the U.S. government started selling inflation-protected securities in the late 90s. It surpassed the routes during the global financial crisis and the taper tantrum of 2013. What does all of this mean for markets?
Okay, so the short reply is that the importance of the 10-year U.S. yield is that it sets the benchmark rate against which almost any return is then set, usually as some function of that rate plus a premium. So in the case of equities, for example, you typically would be looking for an equity market to, over a period of 10 years and more, offer you a return of that 10-year yield plus a premium of, should we say, on average 4%. Now, the point of that is then is the long-term return of those assets is not determined by greed and fear, as our short-term trading friends would point out, but rather more mundane things such as future cash flows. And of course, now, when you have such an adverse environment where the growth rates, earnings are going to be constrained, it clearly then puts pressure on those kind of assets simply because it puts pressure on those rates of return. And the net result is that this puts a heck of a cap on markets in general. So it's quite a profound and quite a broad-ranging set of problems that flow from this pressure.
And, you know, that's the financial market perspective, but there is a clear link, and to Grantham's point here, Raymond, between what's going on in financial markets and what's going on in real economies. And the link here, obviously, being inflation, which is causing interest rates to rise. And with all the geopolitics around Russia and the energy crisis in Europe, Grantham believes this is potentially worse than the global financial crisis with what he's confronted by. Would you go along with that? Do you think the outlook for the economy is as precarious as it was around 07, 08?
Hi, Michael. Look, I think we did make the point last week as well that we must distinguish between, as I put it, Wall Street and, of course, Main Street, and we've got to unpack those trends. To what extent are they coinciding? To what extent are they divergent? So that must obviously influence how one sees the outlook, and one mustn't tilt one's interpretation too much one way or the other. Two have to be brought into a perspective. I just want to go back. The point that you've raised about this whole perspective, if we go back, let's cast our minds back to the big recession of 2008 and 2009. What was the challenge then? Well, we had a financial crisis that threatened to spill over into the real economy. There were liquidity problems. It was financial collapse. What did the central banks do? They jumped in immediately, led by Bernanke in particular. There was world cooperation to soften the impact of that and head off a Great Depression. So we ended up with a recession. So that was the task of the central banks then. Now, of course, it's in reverse. They're now faced with inflation and recession. We call it stagflation. So it's not just a question of recession, it's also a question of how do you deal with inflation. Now, I want to use that metaphor which a great philosopher, Isaiah Berlin, did when he spoke about the hedgehogs and the foxes. He said that he divides the decision makers in the world into hedgehogs who know one big thing and are often right, and the foxes who know many things and are more often right. And I'm saying here, we are in a situation now, when you look at the world situation, you can't be a hedgehog. You've got to be a fox. You've got to be very clever, because you're dealing with a combination of events that was not quite like you dealt with as a central banker and other policymakers in 2008. So I think it's still too early to say there's going to be a worst-case scenario for the world economy. The IMF and other bodies are still forecasting a 3 to 4% growth rate this year. They will probably update it shortly. So I think what's important now is we just need to see what is decided next week. I think it shows how important these decisions are, what the Fed will decide next week. Will their bark be worse than their bite, or will their bite be as bad as their bark? Because quite clearly, what is settled there will set the pattern for our forecasts for the rest of the year, as far as the world economy is concerned.
And are there foxes potentially amongst the hawks or the doves inside the Fed? And we welcome now Isa Mslanga, Chief Economist at Alex Forbes, who was stuck in some kind of Zoom purgatory. Isa, great to have you back on the show again. And we're talking about the issue here of global recession. It seems to be the big talking points in markets at the moment. A Bank of America Merrill Lynch fund managers survey saw that respondents, so market participants at 58%, believe we'll probably see a global recession in the next 12 months. And when we talk global recessions, I think the IMF has only, we've recorded about four since the 1970s. So these are fairly rare events. What tends to happen during global recessions? And what scenarios are you modeling here around the likelihood of a global recession?
Look, I think it makes a lot of sense to expect significant slowdown or a global recession into 2023. Europe, we actually see a significant energy crunch, which is going to push that region into recession. The aggressive hikes of interest rates by the US Fed are also expected to push the US economy into a significant slowdown. So the big two blocks into recession. Normally, we tend to see capital outflows from emerging markets and weakening currencies. And we've already seen a bit of that in this year, which means we should expect a little bit more weakening in the currency as we move into 2023, which reinforces the inflationary pressures that we have been talking about for several weeks now. And as a result, central banks in emerging markets will be under pressure to continue to hike interest rates, just to control those inflationary pressures.
Now, if you look at this, Warwick, I mean, clearly, not all asset classes respond to recession equally, and there are places to invest even during recessions. More defensive sectors, for example, maybe going back into the bond market. Where would you be looking to invest during a period of global recession?
Look, Michael, it does also depend on the type of recession and, for that matter, the monetary environment. And in this case, I mean, it is a supply-side challenge combined with inflation. So I'm going to stick with the comments that I've passed before. Notwithstanding worries about recession and what it will do to demand, we still have an environment in which there is a potentially very strong case for commodities because of the supply-side issues. So I'm still going with that. I mean, at the end of the day, there are real assets. They are in demand, recession or no recession. So that's certainly at the forefront of where I'm prepared to be. I think as Grantham pointed out in his comments that you quote earlier, I mean, he notes there that if you rule out or you forget to adjust for inflation, then that can actually make that bear market a lot worse than it is on paper. And I mean, a very good example of that was the bear markets of 1980 to 82. On paper, that was a 50% market fall. In practice, because of inflation, was actually a 75% market fall. And so that's a pertinent point where when you look at the current inflation numbers that are coming through now as well.
Yeah, very good point.
Michael, another important point here is that when we look at the big picture, where there's still a lot of uncertainties, obviously, the issue is that you hope for the best, but you must prepare now for the worst that could happen. But I think these very generic terms about recession, we'll have to refine them as we go along. It may be a mild world recession. Mm-hmm. It may be a deep one. I think the important point is we do have to some sense of degree. But the world is a very big place, and as Isa said, not everything is going to happen at the same pace. So I think the important point as we move forward is to say, what degree of setback are we anticipating, and then what strategies are appropriate to deal with it?
And on that point then, how would you, as the Cabinet Lekgotla, who's busy mulling over the global conditions and the fact that the world is facing a potential recession, with our second quarter GDP numbers, which were at a negative 0.7% this week, probably slightly less bad than consensus, which was at negative 0.8. But I mean, it's really nibbling around the fringes there, and being mindful of this rising cost of living that is impacting the poor more than most, if you look at the cost of food and the cost of fuel. How should the Cabinet Lekgotla respond to this, given South Africa still has very limited fiscal headroom, Raymond?
Well, let me say immediately that I have two or three things to say about that. The first is, I'd like us to avoid any further pump priming so close to the medium budget strategy event next month. I'd like to see us pull this all together, all the decisions we've taken so far to support the economy, social assistance, pull together next month so we can see where we are and what, how much space have we got, how much room do we have to maneuver. So I think the other point would be, I'd like the Lekgotla to have said, we will concentrate on ensuring that what we have said we will do is being properly implemented. That would be very helpful. In terms of certain assistance schemes that need to be taken off paper and into practice. And I think what one would like to say is that what the Cabinet Lekgotla should really be doing is to focus on issues that promote confidence. So it's on the energy front, on the transport front, all those infrastructural bottlenecks that can make a huge difference to investor confidence if we can remove and expedite what needs to be done there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know the saying that it's confidence building is the cheapest form of stimulation. And that's the big challenge for South Africa now. Whether it's the Cabinet Lekgotla or the medium-term budget, we must come forward with a set of messages and implementation schemes that build confidence. We have a lot of untapped resilience in this economy, but we need to unlock it by boosting confidence. And that's, I think, where we are at the moment.
If I could add to that, you know, sometimes, you know, what we have seen in the public sector or government's response has tended to be very reactive, and it puts in place a stimulus or programs that are not well targeted. I think we must avoid that at all costs because it does not provide the right kind of stimulus. Case in point, the reduction of fuel levies was given to me and you who potentially do not need it, instead of targeting it exactly to the poor who actually need it. So I think government would have to think carefully about whatever package they come with to make sure that it's targeted to those that need it the most. So avoiding those errors sometimes is actually a good thing. So I would think that they think quite long term, don't be reactive in terms of the stimulus package that is being discussed, and better targeted to those that need it the most.
At least, and I take your point there, Isa, but as the finance minister is facing his medium-term budget policy statement, if you look at nominal GDP, what matters for the debt-to-GDP ratio, things are not looking that bad. I mean, 8.6%, yes, it's still low than what you're borrowing at the 10-year long end, but I think the finance minister would take that at this stage, as well as our current account surplus, which is really thanks to commodities. But both of those are really supporting our fiscal position to some extent. And I guess that's where the challenge comes in. And again, I'd like your feedback on this, Isa, on how the finance minister at that cabinet Lekgotla has to convince his cabinet colleagues around the table that, you know, we need to be prudent with this windfall. It's not like we can go and bake in a permanent expenditure like a basic income grant. At the same time, you have to be providing that targeted support to the most vulnerable. It is a specifically difficult challenge, the horns of a dilemma. How would you go about addressing that? Something like maybe a more temporary social relief of distress grant until things return to a more even keel? How would you think about that?
I think given the performance of the fiscus this year that's coming in, that you highlight that it might perform in a decent way, it makes a lot of sense to provide very short-term relief package. But as we have learned in other economies, the US still has a short-term relief package that was implemented in 1945 during the Second World War. So these short-term relief packages, sometimes they become crystallized and made permanent. So we need to be able to avoid that and make sure that it's time bound, but also helps people to transition out of the social support from the state once the economy rebound, and still focus more on the structural issues that makes the economy more investor friendly and conducive. That's the most important thing. We shouldn't necessarily look at the short term while we are forgetting or losing sight of the long-term issues that we have.
Now, I think this is important, Michael, because all the forecasts, not all, they're optimists and pessimists about our growth rate next year and the year after. To get a better outcome, you need to boost investment. As ISO said, yes, there are short-term things to be done. They've got to be fitted into the bigger picture next month, but it's got to come out with a message that we are unblocking the obstacles that prevent us from boosting investor confidence to the level at which we can expect better growth rates. Mm.
But we are already at that point to an extent, aren't we? Raymond, if you look at what has happened in the energy sector, and I was hosting a panel earlier this week with Kevin Lings and Busi Mavuso and Mamela Matikinka and Gwenya, the chief economist at FNB, and they're all revising, not that Busi Mavuso is an economist, but the economists on the panel were revising their growth rates upward from 2024, thanks largely to the expected investment that's going to be invested into the economy through the energy reform program, and above 2%, 2.4. So we're getting closer to that 3. I know we probably need to be closer to 5. But should we not now really recognize that the reform agenda is actually starting to gain traction, material traction inside government, while continuing to push for reforms in things like transport and other areas? It does seem like those shibboleths are finally being slayed. Raymond?
I think so. I mean, I agree with that. But I think we've discussed it so often, only to find that that there's a level of disappointment if you don't keep the pressure up. It's not enough to say it's happening. It's got to be seen to be happening. And whatever was said last week, there are some other decision makers who are still very unhappy with the pace at which things are being done. So I'm saying the important issue there, and I think we'd agreed on that, actually, that we need to walk that extra mile.
Yeah,
we've been, I think, obsessed about energy. That's in the box now. There are other infrastructure issues, such as transport, where the same progress has not yet been made. And all we're saying, or I'm saying, is let's keep our foot on the accelerator there, because that's how you boost confidence, and that's how you get the investment which boosts your longer-term growth and employment. Mm. That's the message. and we mustn't be part of it.
Just one last comment, Warwick, from you on this broader discussion around the cabinet Lekgotla, what we've seen out of second quarter GDP and reform. How do you see the market reacting to all of this at the moment, and what would you like to see emerge from this cabinet Lekgotla?
Look, Michael, I think the one comment, which perhaps might be a bit glib, but I'll pass it anyway, is that to me this whole issue of governments providing packages perhaps is the same kind of problem the retailers encounter when they decide, are we going to offer good value everyday pricing, or are we going to do a whole bunch of specials? And the packages basically feel like a bunch of specials. And as Isaiah pointed out, you need to be very careful of letting those specials turn into something that's then stuck forever being a problem on your business. Mm. So I think we have the same issue here. Courtesy of COVID and assorted other crises in recent years, I almost feel like we almost specialed or packaged out. And as Raymond pointed out, you know, keeping the pedal to the metal and just focusing on building the long-term delivery, I think is really where government needs to be at. And as Raymond points out, they need to keep alluding to their progress. One, that's so that morale and confidence is picked up as a result of this delivery. And two, simply pointing out that that's actually where efforts need to be made and focus needs to be kept.
Yes, one last one. I think it's a quick win. Government needs to realize opportunities that are created by shocks elsewhere. Europe is going into a winter that is going to be cold. It's coming into summer here, which means tourism can actually do well. Government must just come up with a program to fix our safety and security. The currency is weak, which means it's cheaper for foreign tourists to come into the country. Then they must just market the country appropriately to say, come, it's warm, spend your dollars and euros, and then people can find a lot of employment, which does not require very high skills. It's a good opportunity government can take.
And it was one of the bright spots that came through in that GDP number. And Bidvest results this week seem to indicate that there is a pickup around events and restaurants and that kind of thing. Raymond, speaking of Europe, the other big talking point this week is whether or not Liz Truss can be the one to fix Britain. And I don't know if you'd rather be in Cyril's shoes or Liz's shoes right now, given the long list of issues impacting Britain at the moment. Some expect inflation there next year to peak at 20%, and they're facing one of their coldest winters ever. Is she the woman for the job?
Well, it's hard to say at this point. I think, you know, she does come from a very experienced background in the cabinet. She served under several prime ministers. In fact, it's interesting to note they've had four prime ministers in 6 years in the United Kingdom, which also tells you something. But the fact is, she's coming to the post, I think, with a lot of experience. She has campaigned on a set of views. There are huge economic challenges, in some cases bigger than ours, because they are clear and present dangers in a way ours are not. And I think her speech to Parliament today will tell us in more detail how she's going to deal with the energy crisis, which is on their doorstep and is of a huge magnitude. And what she says today will be very important for indeed business confidence and consumer confidence in the United Kingdom. I would just divide from a South African point of view just two aspects. The short term is that clearly bad news on this scale for one of our major markets is something which our exporters must, of course, interrogate, watch what's happening, what will their market shares be for their exports if they go into a deep recession in as far as that country is concerned. So that's something that our exporters would have to have a look at. But in the longer term, in the post-Brexit era, it's clear that the United Kingdom is going to look for alternative markets. And coming back to the point that, of course, that was made by ISA, we must be alert. Don't waste a good crisis, wherever it may be, and see what opportunities there are that we can position ourselves in the longer term, given where the UK wants to go in the world economy, what bigger opportunities will be there for South Africa in the post-Brexit phase of the United Kingdom, and how successful or not the new Prime Minister will be in dealing with their clear and present economic dangers that she has to now address in the next few weeks.
Well, Raymond, thank you very much. We're going to have to leave it there. Her desire to ignite growth, to create, in her words, this aspiration nation in Britain, have yet to be fully articulated. So looking forward to that address. That was Raymond Parsons of Northwest University Business School, joined by Warwick Lucas of Galileo Securities and Isaac Plunger, Chief Economist at Alex Forbes, putting the week in perspective here on Business Watch.